Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to Candidate Confessional. I'm Sam Stein.
And I'm Jason Cherkis.
And a couple of weeks ago, you, the listener, heard from Congressman Barney Frank about the efforts to integrate gays into the military. Now, at the end of that interview, the former congressman made the point that for a while, people were warning that if gays were allowed to openly serve in the military, or even if they were just allowed to marry each other, it would be deeply destabilizing to both those institutions. At this point, he says, most people have forgotten that they ever had those fears.
The same is true about gay political candidates who run for office. Today, no one bats an eye when that happens. No one cares about their sexuality. Nope. But that wasn't always the case.
No, as recently as 1996, there were only 3 openly gay people in all of Congress. In that year, 2 of them decided to retire. Good old Barney Frank, our podcast guest, was the last one standing.
That year, however, there were 2 openly gay candidates running for office. One of them was Dale McCormick of Maine. The other was Rick Zuber in Long Beach, California.
Now, this was historic. Frank and others had only come out after being elected. This was the first time a gay politician was running for Congress with their sexuality not being a secret. It was a big deal. The Advocate ran a story headline, quote, "The Challenger. This year could be the first in which an openly gay candidate for Congress ousts an incumbent." The picture in that piece was Rick.
They covered that story, and they covered his candidacy every month. It was big news, and it was incredibly important. And on today's episode, we have none other than Rick Zuber. Rick Zuber.
You'll figure it out. Yes, we sat down with the former California congressional candidate to talk about his campaign from 21 years ago, how he ended up being a test case for dealing with running for office while you're out, and what it was like to be in a country where homophobia was still rampant. Welcome to Candidate Confessional.
In the early 90s, Rick Zuber was working at a law firm called Latham & Watkins. He wasn't exactly in the closet, but he wasn't quite out either. His coworkers generally didn't know he was gay.
When I started there, there were no openly gay lawyers in the entire firm. Wasn't a bad place. In fact, I ended up becoming the first person to make partner at the firm, coming out in my 5th or 6th year. And it was in part because I decided to do a gay and lesbian fundraiser for Barbara Boxer when she was running for the United States Senate in the primary. And it started out as this little house party, and I started getting, but it was one of the first times that even in California, any candidate for office was willing to sort of accept help from the LGBT community in a public way. And so when that happened, my friends and I just decided we were going to do this little thing at my house. And it ended up like mushrooming into this huge fundraiser with like 600 people. I told the Boxer campaign, it's not going to fit at my house. They thought I was like some naive kid that was making up that all these people were going to show up. And I finally forced them to move it to the Roosevelt Hotel. And we ended up having like 700 people show up. And it made the LA Times. And of course, I was listed as one of the organizers. And of course, that was read by everyone at my law firm. And of course, I then came out.
Became a player. Yeah.
What was that like the day you came into the law firm after the fundraiser? Made headlines. Was that nerve-wracking for you in some way?
No, not really. I mean, I think people generally
do. It's an odd
way
to come out, I have to say. It's I'm going to do a big fundraiser, and they'll figure it out through the press.
A bold name in the LA Times was it.
The firm was incredibly, incredibly supportive. I mean, one of the nice things about Latham & Watkins is it's truly a meritocracy. I was doing really well there. Sure. And I remember my department chair asked me to lunch a couple days later, and I thought it was about something we were working on for work, and she basically – asked me to sort of come into her office, and she had a big conference table, and she had lunch served, and she basically said, "So,
we read the paper."
No, she said, I heard you came out last night. And I said, well, I didn't really, it wasn't anything I was ever really hiding. But she said, I just want you to know it's okay with me and it's okay with everyone. And we're really proud of you.
The reason we're talking to you is because back in 1996, you ran for Congress.
For Congress in the 38th Congressional District.
Which is what?
At that time, it's a little bit different now since redistricting, but at that time it included most of the city of Long Beach and then some of the communities just to the north, sort of south of Los Angeles, and Long Beach was the biggest city.
What was the community like?
Well, I mean, it's changed a little bit since I ran.
Back then.
Back then, it was the most Democratic seat held by Republican in California and one of the most Democratic seats. It was being represented by a so-called moderate Republican.
Named Stephen Horn,
who got elected a bit because he was sort of a local folk hero. It really was a Democratic district. It had been represented by a Democrat before that.
Why was Horn a local folk hero?
Well, he had been president of Cal State Long Beach. So he was able to sort of, in that role, sort of portray himself as being, sort of nonpartisan and, you know, back in those days, this was, you know, right after the Republicans took control of the Congress.
This
with the
94
with the Contract on America. And he actually had represented that he was going to be a moderate and, you know, of course, started voting with all the Republicans to cut Medicare and Social Security and all of those.
As they do.
How did he win? I mean, you talk about being a folk hero, but it does seem miraculous that he won this.
Well, there was a
it was 94, man. Yeah. It was a brutal year for Democrats.
Well, so there were a
I'm 22, Sam. I don't know anything about this.
That is a lie, but go on.
So there was a lot of Republicans the year that – and this was before I ran.
Yeah.
So this was two cycles before. There were a lot of Republicans who ran in the race. And the Republicans in California are really super conservative. So there were probably – I can't remember – 6 or 7 Republicans that were all super conservative. One had run right after Clinton Anderson resigned. There was a little bit of a scandal with his campaign and the combination of that, plus his being able to present himself as sort of a moderate. He won a narrow victory.
Well, why did you want to run?
I had just made partner at my law firm. I had become much more politically active in part because of the AIDS crisis and really the Republicans not doing anything about it. I had really close friends who had died and were sick. My then partner was HIV positive. Frankly, I'm a progressive Democrat and saw what the Republicans were trying to do thought that I could make a difference.
So I guess we should explain – I mean the reason we're having you on this podcast is – and I want to make sure I get this right. Were you the first openly gay non-elected official to run for Congress, non-incumbent to run for Congress?
I wasn't correct? The first to run. So in 1996 there were the first time that we had four out candidates that were running for Congress in different districts across the country. And two of them were not really all that viable. They were running in very conservative districts. And then Dale McCormick was running up in Maine. And then my district, because of the fact that it was a Democratic district held by Republican, was also viewed as a target by the Democrats.
Sure.
So ours were the sort of the two most viable districts, and
there were openly gay members of Congress,
Barney Frank and Gary Studs had all been, but they had not run initially as openly gay candidates. So
they'd come out while they were in office.
So when I ran the primary, I was the first openly gay person to win a contested primary for United States Congress.
Were you recruited? I mean, how did it get to you run?
Yes and no. I wouldn't sort of say I think the party at the time had mixed views about there were some folks in the party that I think really thought it was time for an LGBT candidate to step forward. And so I think there was a lot of enthusiasm, but there was in some parts of the party leadership a lot of nervousness. And they said, you know, do we really want some gay guy to be carrying the torch in one of our lead and targeted seats? So
yeah, what kind of negative feedback did you get? I mean, because for some people, some of our listeners, they may not know that there was a time when there wasn't gay marriage, when there wasn't
LGBTQ rights when it wasn't sort of mainstream the way it is now. And I'm wondering what it was.
Yeah, what was the climate like, right? I mean, it's, well, it no seems one, so
I mean, there were no Democrats supported gay marriage other than gay people, right? And there were only in California, there were only
that's including
a
the
couple,
president.
Right? Yeah, there were only a couple openly gay people that had been elected to office. You had Sheila Kuehl, who was already in the assembly, and Carol Migdon. And those were sort of the first two. I think Carol had already been elected. So I think that was sort of it. And then we had a number. Obviously, we had openly gay people in San Francisco. And Jackie Goldberg had recently been elected to the city council, first LGBT person in Los Angeles. So it was really it was really still pretty uncommon to have gay candidates.
Okay, before we get into Rick's campaign for Congress, I think it's worth pausing for a moment to remember just what the big cultural attitudes towards gays and lesbians were in the mid-1990s. We're accustomed at this point to a world in which gay marriage is legal and gays can serve openly in the military, but things were very different back then. Just hearing the way gay issues were discussed on the news, it could be a little jarring.
Halloween is traditionally the night when San Francisco gays get together to celebrate their lifestyle.
A Washington State newspaper infuriated some of its readers when it printed this marriage announcement from a lesbian couple.
In custody battles, four states deem gay parents unfit. Psychologist Charlotte Patterson, a lesbian.
And in Congress, the rhetoric about gay rights or gay marriage was a lot more intense.
To insist that male-male or female-female relationships must have the same status as the marriage relationship is more than unwise, is patently absurd.
The very foundations of our society are in danger of being burned. The flames of hedonism, the flames of narcissism, the flames of self-centered morality are licking at the very foundations of our society.
With the exception of Barney Frank, who sounded pretty much like he does today.
I find it implausible that two men deciding to commit themselves to each other threaten the marriage of people a couple of blocks away.
Well, just talk a little bit more about the culture in that moment, mid-90s. We're coming off of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which was a defeat in some respects, even though progress was made.
The Ellen Show is still on the air.
The Ellen Show is on
the air.
I'm not
sure if she came out.
Bill Clinton is, you know, sort of famously playing these cultural wars a little bit against his own party. It's not the modern age. It's a difficult time, I would say, to be openly gay still.
It was a difficult time. There was a lot of question about whether a gay candidate could win in a major race. No one had ever won for Congress ever before running as an openly gay candidate. I remember we gave lots and lots of thought to how we would inoculate me for what would ultimately be attacks based upon my sexual orientation. I chose my pollster based upon the fact that he had actually done a lot of polling for lower level candidates in gay candidates and other races. You know, the entire campaign strategy was guided in part by the fact that we knew that I had to, that was going to be an issue.
Well, I just want to interject one second because I think you touched on something that I'm curious about, which is the LGBT community, let's say the gay rights community at that point in time, had spent the 80s, early 90s sort of outside the political process, banging the doors, calling for action, but never actually becoming a firm part of the political process. Was there a conscientious decision within the community and maybe within yourself to say, you know what, we can't just be outsiders. We need to be within the system trying to affect that change.
I wouldn't say that it was that there was some kind of, you know, LGBT
come to Jesus moment.
board or yeah, some yeah, kind of strategy sure. group enough, that enough. Was plotting things out.
You know, five people in a room.
Yeah. It's yeah, no, it was very decentralized. I think all of us were doing things in our own communities. And when I decided to run for Congress, I mean, I think there were actually people in the LGBT community who said, you know, this is a big step up. You've never run for office before. You know, are you really viable? And
what was their nervousness that if you got defeated badly, it would be a sign of, you know, a setback in some respects?
Well, the other thing is that, you know, we had in Steve Horn someone who wasn't all that great on LGBT rights, but then actually when I ended up coming into the race and raising lots of money, frankly, I mean, I think at one point, I think I was probably the fourth or fifth highest raising non-incumbent on the Democratic Party that cycle. And so he could sort of see a well-funded candidate coming in on the other side. And then all of a sudden, he basically decides that he's going to support Enda because, you know, there's a gay community. And I mean, there is a gay community in Long Beach. Yeah. And so what we had been looking at a lot of the polling data, and we said, okay, how much am I going to be hurt by being a gay candidate? And is it offset by the fact that we actually have a pretty big gay voting bloc in Long Beach that can offset that? And I think our conclusion was, yes, that was likely to be the case.
What did the polling tell you about how people would receive a gay candidate?
And I don't think this changes very much on any issue, but I think what, you know, we knew that there was going to be a base in that district of about, I can't remember the exact number, but 33, 34% that would never vote for me. But they also wouldn't vote for me because I was pro-choice and because I was in favor of gun safety regulations and, was a Democrat and a progressive. And so we thought the biggest question that we had was there going to be some kind of Tom Bradley effect, you know, of people.
Explain that for the listener.
Well, Tom Bradley, remember, ran for governor in California. He was the first, black African American, maybe not the first, but obviously had been the mayor of Los Angeles. And was running for governor, and the polls showed that he should have won. And then in the end, he lost. And I think a lot of people wondered whether or not the polling was accurate and whether there was bias that was not
the
being
idea
revealed
being
in
that
poll.
You wouldn't want to tell a pollster that you weren't going to vote against a guy because you thought you might be portrayed as racist. So you
right.
lied to the pollster.
So you lied to the pollster. So we always wondered how much of that might happen.
I'm wondering if – so how did you had to handle or sort of modulate your message? What, were you going to be the gay candidate? Were you going to be the Democrat, progressive candidate? We've had people on here. We had a candidate last season who had really difficulty running as a gay candidate in the South and sort of had to sort of figure out, never really could figure out how to talk about gay marriage in a way that felt honest to him. And he ended up saying things that he regretted. And I'm wondering if you had to figure out, how am I going to modulate my message to appeal to the most people, or am I going to be who I am and forget the rest?
I didn't lead with the fact that I was a gay candidate. If people ever asked me, and it was always, you know, every newspaper article in Long Beach was Rick Zabur, you know, an openly gay candidate.
Yes.
They couldn't not ever say, you don't see that very much anymore.
No, you don't.
Right? Hardly ever. But back then, every newspaper article said it. So
it was like your title, basically.
Pretty much. I mean, I had a second candidate, Democrat and gay. So.
But in the framing of, say, the Medicaid cuts, you had said, you had talked to the Advocate, I think, or they quoted you saying this, that those cuts would especially hurt the HIV people living with HIV. So you were framing it in some ways on I think maybe communities that weren't heard from in those ways.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would always talk about the issues that – but you know, there was actually a funny story at one point.
Go on.
One of the things that we did is that we knew that one of the ways that opponents of gay candidates, they really try to attack the integrity of the candidate. They try to make them seem other, like they're different. And one of our strategies in some of our early mail pieces, which were just positive pieces about me, were really about me showing me with my family and showing me with my brothers and sisters and showing me with my parents. I think the first piece was called Respect and talked about sort of my respect for values of respect and values. And there was a picture of me at the end. And I remember we got a call into the campaign office and someone says, you know, there's someone who's got your piece of mail and he wants to talk to you. Will you take the call? And I said, oh yeah. I said, cause I'd take calls if people called in and want to talk to me. And I said, yeah, sure. And he goes, and then they said, well, I just want you to know before you take the call that this person said that the reason why they're calling is because you and Pat Buchanan are their favorite candidates. So I sat back and I thought, are we laying on this family stuff a little bit too heavy?
Was there ever a thing where they wanted you to do something to make you look even more like Pat, you know, like put
no,
you
– No. I mean, everything. I was really comfortable with it. I mean,
like
obviously –
a pitchfork and a hayfield.
No. It was really just but you know, back in those days
– shotgun. Give him a gun.
Like, you shoot the bill. So you had to go through a primary first. It wasn't.
I did.
It wasn't like you were going to necessarily walk and be the Democrat.
No, and I was running against the Democratic nominee from this high cycle before.
Okay.
So he had lost badly in the general and was viewed as he was viewed in part as the more progressive candidate. In reality, he wasn't more progressive. I mean, I think his cosmetic was a little bit different. But if you looked at sort of our positions on the issues, they were almost identical.
What did you learn from the primary? I mean, it's your first time running a
race. Was it your first time running any
for It was. First time running I'd ever run for office.
Okay.
One, it's a lot harder than you think. So one of the things is about 3 weeks before the election, almost everyone thought I was going to lose. There were some polls that had been taken by the party. It was we didn't know this, but it was showing that I was way down.
This is in the primary?
In the primary. I was sitting on $300,000 that I wasn't planning on spending in the primary because I figured I'd sort of save it for the general because I knew that the general was going to be really tough. And so basically my main campaign consultant just sort of cut and run. He just wasn't around. He didn't think that anything could happen. We ended up I ended up just saying, okay, let's just spend the rest of the money. And so –
yeah, no need to hang on to that if you're going
to lose. So we just – we basically did what – you know, we were – we've had paid phone banks. We put in, I think, 9 additional pieces of mail went out in different targeted ways, not with my consultant, but with the pollster and my field consultant doing the mail because we had to do this in like 5 days. Remember, the you know, you have to print it. It's got to get to the post office. It's got to be delivered while people are printing. So it was like –
this is old school.
It was like – it was just like a cram session for 5 days, like just chucking out pieces of mail. In the end, I won the live vote by about 8%. So I had come up on people that had voted that day like 20 points in 3 weeks. And the reason why I was so close was that all the people that had voted early who, you know, it reflected sort of the fact that I was behind. So I lost the absentee and won the live vote, and it was enough to sort of get me over.
Why do you think you were so behind 3 weeks out? Was it just name recognition or what was it?
No one knew the guy.
I didn't know. No one knew me. Seriously, I think that's it. I think my mail consultant.
Obscure lawyer doing environmental law. Who knows this guy?
No, and we'd only done like 4 or 5 pieces of mail, and I wasn't smart enough to know that that wasn't going to be enough.
But you were sitting on $300,000.
And I was sitting on $300,000.
Spend the money.
Right?
He thought people individually read each piece of mail and didn't just chuck it.
After the break, with the primary behind him, Riggsburg gets ready to take on his Republican foe in the general election. And he gets a little friendly advice from good old Barney Frank.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
So you're now the candidate, you're running. Did you ever like reach out to Barney or
Oh, Barney was great.
Ask him like, listen, I'm in uncharted.
Barney area. Would call me every week or two.
What would he say?
Yeah.
He would give me advice.
And only a Barney Frank fashion.
Yeah, no, it was all very well meaning.
Some of it you can understand, some of it was unintelligible.
No, he was amazing. He really was. He came out to the district several times, did fundraisers. I mean, he'd call up, but if he didn't like something that I was doing, I'd get a call. It's like, it's Congressman Frank. And I'm like, okay, I'll take the call. I'd brace myself a little bit. He was very frank on sort of what he thought, but good advice.
What was some of the advice you were getting?
I mean, the other people, it's like, you know, Henry Waxman was amazing. Congresswoman Pelosi, who was not in the leadership at the time, sort of adopted me. It was really a very –
Were you getting – what I want to get is, were you getting actual tangible pieces of advice about what to do about your sexuality or whether – or how to emphasize certain elements or policy positions? I mean, what were people trying to sort of walk you through what to expect?
No. I think people were people knew that I had good – campaign consultants on the messaging related to the sexual orientation. And I think that they had seen what we were doing. They agreed with the strategy that I had come up with. It was really more on, you know, when you're a candidate, obviously, and especially in California, there were a bunch of seats that the Democrats were trying to take back in order to take back the House. And there's a certain amount of competition that's occurring among the congressional candidates about who's getting the profile from the party, who's getting the money from the party, who's
getting visits from the officials.
Yeah, who gets the speaking role at the national convention, all of those kinds of things. I think the thing that was really interesting to me at the time is that, you know, the LGBT mafia that was embedded in Washington and in all the unions and in the party, those people were with me, and I had help that I never would have imagined would have been the case beforehand. You know, there were gay staffers all over the place that were, you know, that knew that this was a significant race for our community and were doing everything they could to try to help me.
Did you ever think about, I mean, because, and I want to make sure I'm getting your actual communication strategy correct. You weren't hiding the fact that you were gay. You were answering questions, but it wasn't the central focus.
It was not the central focus.
Did you ever think that maybe making it the central focus, that you were a historic candidate, you were trying to do what no one else had done before, that maybe you could have become a cause? Or was it just not the right time for that?
You know, I think – so one, I never hit it. I mean, you have different aspects of a campaign. You have aspects of messaging to your donors. You have aspects of messaging to the broader press, the local press and the national press. We were getting lots and lots of national press coverage. I mean, it was not like making it sort of more of a cause, I think, would have sort of helped me electorally. And in the district, everyone knew that I was gay. They used it against me. I mean, there was stuff that, you know, in the end, you know, Steve Horn, even though he was claimed that he was not against the LGBT community, ended up, when I came close in the general election, we did a poll that showed I was within, I think, 4 or 5 points against, you know, the sitting incumbent. And he got worried and he started doing mail pieces in the conservative parts of the district that basically the cover said, is Steve Horn anti-gay? And then you'd open it up and say, no, he'd never use the fact that Rick Zabur is a homosexual against him in this race.
Which was, of course, using it against you in the race.
Right.
There was also there were some phone calls, a pollster I read made what is essentially a push poll, asking about whether people were, you know, how they felt about your sexuality. Was that from the Horn campaign?
I don't know. We never figured out where that came from. But we knew that people were doing leafleting. They were doing leafleting in the conservative churches. There was a piece with President Clinton had come out to campaign for me at one point, and there was a picture of me shaking hands with him, and it had Clinton and a picture of President Clinton and me, and then it basically had a caption below, do you want a homosexual representing you in our congressional district? And, you know, we would see these things coming up all the time. We had, you know, lots of crazy hate calls coming in the district all the time. And we'd come in every morning. And that was back at the days when you had, like, recorded answering machines.
Yeah.
What kind of messages? So you were getting hate messages every morning?
Pretty much every day. Yeah, every day. If at one point, the Long Beach police had to put a police detail on my house because they found someone in my backyard, and when they traced the police plates, then they, you know, we had police officers towards the end of the general election. You know, it was a really different time. I mean, it was really unusual to have an open the gate candidate.
What did that do for the campaign or for you, like when you're running and getting these waking up and the first thing you're listening to are these hate messages and then the security at your house? I mean, at some point, did that freak you out? Or, I mean, how does that play on you mentally?
You think about it. I think I was sort of prepared for it. You know, I think it really steeled them. You know, they just sort of realized that it was – that the race was significant, you know. But I'd see these things. I mean, they'd bring them into me. I mean, sometimes we'd get these things in the mail, which were like crazy people, you know, just like scripture, like a full piece of butcher paper with scribbled stuff all over about, you know, where I was going to go in the afterlife and, you know, all kinds of scripture stuff with obscenities interlaced into it. And, you know, we would get that kind of stuff all the time.
The obscenities were in the Bible.
Yeah. In a quote from the Bible and then an obscenity. Yeah. And then where I was going to go.
But did you worry about going to campaign events for your safety at any
point?
Not
really. Maybe I should have, but.
I'm wondering if you had any sort of moments. I mean, in every campaign, you go to these events and you're meeting strangers. I'm wondering if you're, hey, take my picture. And I'm wondering if you were ever worried about anybody coming up to you and wanting to take your picture or wanting to sort of interact with you. And you're like, I don't know where this guy's coming from. I'm a little bit – he might be somebody that's not in my best interest or an enemy.
I mean, I think, you know, I was always more worried in things like gay pride parades because there were so many people in the crowds and those kinds of things. But, you know, we just didn't. It was just sort of a fact of life at the time. There was not much you could do about it. I wasn't going to not run a campaign because of some potential fear that's out there.
How do you put all that sort of stuff aside and not like lash out or punch a wall or, you know, yell at somebody? Maybe that's not what you do.
Infamous puncher. You know, Rick's. I guess I'm curious. This might be an incredibly naive question, but, you know, the most infamous or famous, I should say, case of a gay man running California's Harvey Milk, obviously, and the assassination. And I mean, that was well before your congressional run. But to Jason's point, was it ever in the back of your mind, that story?
Oh, of course it was. I mean, I remember when we found the person and the, you know, we were telling the police periodically about the, you know, the death threats, and we were getting death threats. I mean, that was part of what was coming, some of what was coming in on the thing. And so the police were sort of monitoring it, and we were not paying too much attention until they actually did put the detail on my house towards the end of the campaign. And then I was a little bit nervous about it. But, you know, again, you can't let fear of, you know, prevent you from making progress.
I want to just read you, with respect to the attacks that your opponent was making, and I guess some of these attacks coming in, I want to read a quote that I found of yours about how you approached these attacks. You said, "The last thing you want as an openly gay candidate is to have the dialogue in the campaign be whether or not homophobic activities are occurring." That was your rationalization for not responding to the vitriol that was sending right to the push polls, to the stuff from your opponent. Explain that thinking.
Well, we knew that for me to get elected in that district, that we needed to talk about the issues that voters cared about. And so, you know, that if we had been responding to those kinds of things, which were basically happening pretty frequently, and I think are probably the case, were pretty common for most gay candidates that were running for office, we would have been talking about issues that they wanted to talk about, not issues.
It was their terrain,
right?
I mean, did in your conversations with Barney Frank or Nancy Pelosi, did they give you advice on just how to deal with this, how to navigate this? I mean, I'm sure Frank has probably gotten hate mail, that kind of thing. Obviously, he went through it.
I don't remember that we ever sort of spoke about those issues all that much. I think, you know, really what, most of the advice that Frank was sort of giving me were things about, you know, what the mail should look like and how I should be spending my, whether I was doing enough field and whether we were doing enough walking and, you know, how we were using the budget and, you know, whether we were raising
enough
money.
So he'd ask you like, "Hey, how many doors did you knock on?"
Pretty much, actually.
Really? He's like, doing your door knocking count.
You know, I remember getting a call from him and was like, "Why the heck are you going to Pennsylvania to raise money? You need to be back in the district knocking on doors." I remember specifically.
And did he critique your mail?
No. He didn't do that. But he was very focused, and he was right. He was very focused on making sure that we were spending enough time actually talking to the voters and making, you know, doing enough field, spending enough of our, you know, we actually ran a campaign where we didn't have a lot of fluffy expenses. I mean, you want as much as you raise to go into communicating with voters in your district. And so if you get too distracted from that, then it's just, you know, it's
so
not
one,
helping you.
One thing that happened that I was surprised is that the Human Rights Campaign did a double endorsement. They endorsed you and Horn. That is bullshit. That does seem like bullshit. Thank you. He's calling what it is. That's kind of crazy, though.
Yeah. In all defense of my friends at Human Rights Campaign, and we work really well with them at Equality California.
I don't want to get them in trouble now. But back in '96, you must have been furious.
Let me tell you
how you really feel.
At the time, I felt a lot of the same emotions that you just espoused. If you sort of look at it from their perspective, they were really trying to advance ENDA and basically were trying to get Republicans on board. And, you know, Horn was someone who would talk to them. And frankly, when I came into the race, they were talking about how they were going to endorse Republicans who jumped onto ENDA. And, you know, the fact that he jumped onto ENDA after I came into the race, they were in a really difficult position because he was one of a handful of Republicans that was actually going to do that. So, you know, I remember talking to their political director at the time, and I just said, look, you know, just do the dual endorsement. It's just because they were going to stay out. They were going to stay out of the race. And to me, staying out was worse than them doing a dual endorsement, because I had people in other parts of the country that were donors that were basically saying, OK, is the staying out mean that he doesn't have a chance to win, or he's some kind of crazy person? The dual endorsement at least gave sort of the seal of approval on the race. And frankly, I knew that he wasn't going to be raising money from people who cared about gay rights at the time, and that would help me.
Still crazy, man. I can't. That's just shocking to me. So when did you know that you weren't going to win? Did you ever think you were going to win?
I did think I was going to win. Okay. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it. I think I realized I wasn't going to win probably about 4 or 5 days before the election. And I actually remember having a conversation with my campaign consultant. Her name was Mary Hughes, who basically was the same consultant who actually won with Ellen Tauscher that same cycle. And she's actually been the consultant for a lot of the women congressional candidates in California. And I remember talking to her and I said, you know, Mary, do you really think I can win this? Because I had about $200,000 or $300,000 that I had to make a decision on whether I was
you
gonna,
and saving hundreds of thousands.
No,
of
we
dollars.
Were going to spend it.
Okay,
we were going to spend it, but we had all the last it was probably maybe a week in advance. We had all the mail printed, and we had all this mail printed that was going out in the last week, and I had to pay for the postage, which is about half the cost of the mail pieces. So I went back and I said, you know, I've got this couple $100,000. Should I just basically use it for someone else? There were other candidates that I cared about, and I could have, it was legal at that time, I think, to sort of transfer to use it in some other way. And I said, you know, do you really think I have a shot? Am I wasting this money? Is this all cosmetic and for vanity if I go forward with that? And she actually convinced me. She said, no, you've got a shot. You can't give up now. Get your mail out. So we made the decision then. But I think I basically had an inkling that I probably wasn't going to win. It was probably about a week out. After the fact, though, it was actually interesting. She called me about 2 weeks after the election. And, you know, it wasn't that – it turned out not being all that close. But she basically said that she had looked at all the numbers. And she said, you know, I just want to give you some good news and some bad news. And I said, okay, shoot. She goes, if you had had about $700,000 or $800,000 more, you could have won that race, because I'm looking at the numbers. And it was sort of, I said, well, there was no way I could raise another $700,000.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah. But anyway, it was an interesting time.
What was the thing, you know, the 5 or 6 days out that led you know that you were going to lose? What was it? Was there a moment or a poll of data, somebody from
Barney Frank calling you up?
I don't remember. I just sort of think that, some of it was we were getting a lot of the negative mail from the Horn campaign. So, you know, the anti-LGBT hits, the paper was against me in the general. It was actually pretty funny. Papers take sides in races. They liked me in the primary. So it's like nothing I could do. Everything was positive about the campaign. I could do no wrong. Literally a week after I win the primary, all this negative things that keeps coming out in the papers. He's running glossy mail. You know, it's like no different than anyone else's mail in the rest of the country. But in Long Beach, for some reason, sending out glossy flyers,
was a no-no?
Glossy, expensive flyers. I was like, you know, became like a big campaign issue. And so everything I did was sort of negatively covered. And it was sort of, you know, it was just, you know, article after article after article about little tiny things.
So when you lost, I mean, obviously the it's a personal defeat. Were you hopeful, though, that you had maybe sort of opened people's minds to the possibility of electing someone who is openly gay to Congress?
Yeah. In fact, I talked to Tammy Baldwin. She ran the next cycle. And so I remember when she was making the decision to
– let's explain. Tammy is from
Wisconsin. Who was then – in 1998, this was really 2 years – you know, she – I think I talked to her probably 4 or 5 months after I lost, and she was already thinking about running for Congress in that congressional district in Wisconsin. And so, you know, spent a bunch of time with her on the phone, sort of giving her sort of my sense of sort of what the challenges were and what she was going to face, and giving her some recommendations on different consultants that I had talked to and ones that I thought were sort of understood how to help a gay candidate, a gay or lesbian candidate. And obviously, you know, Tammy went on to win, and she actually did, sort of break that glass ceiling by being the first openly LGBT person to get elected to Congress running.
And now in the U.S. Senate.
What kind of feedback did you get from the gay community after the election? Did people feel like, oh, that you let them down in some way? Or did people have positive feedback for you? I mean, I'm wondering, I don't know how.
You know, no one gives you directly the negative feedback. That's very seldom. I remember like 2 days after the election, and I was actually sleeping in late, and the phone rang. It was, I think, something like probably 9:30 or 10 in the morning. And then I'm like in bed. I'd gone through like a year a race at that point. I decided to sleep in, and all of a sudden it's basically said, I've got a call from the White House. And I'm like, oh, I better like sort of wake up really fast. And of course it was Vice President Gore calling to congratulate me for the run. I felt like I'd let people down. It was probably the reason why I didn't run the next cycle. Because I did get a lot of people that wanted me to run again. And frankly, I probably would have won in the next cycle, but not knowing that at the time, just because there weren't really Clinton coattails in 1996. In 1998, the Democrats, there was frankly, the person who ran in that seat actually was a lesbian who ended up getting the party nomination because most of the candidates that were more credible both LGBT and non-LGBT, you know, the sitting elected officials, the state assembly members, the state senators, they looked at my race and they said, you know, that guy spent like $1.5 million, which at that time was a huge amount of money.
Crazy amount, yeah.
He couldn't unseat Horn, so none of us are going to try for that. So there were really no strong candidates running. And this woman who was a lesbian ends up getting the party nomination. I think, I don't remember how much, she spent $87,000 in the race and came closer to winning than I did with no communication. And it was just the cycle.
Were you I did
look at that. I'm like, I could have
glossy mailers.
I could have had my glossy mailers out there and we could have been communicating with folks. But I didn't. The reason why I didn't was because I looked at it and I said, you know, I gave it my best shot. I ran a strong campaign. I raised the money I needed to do to communicate with the voters. I walked all these precincts, had good help. I didn't think that, and at that point now he had been in three terms, the sitting incumbent. And, yeah. At some point the incumbent gets embedded and it's really hard to unseat them.
Yeah.
So that's why I didn't run the second time. But.
So I don't know if your perceptions for how politics would change after race were, but, you know, it would be many, many years until we got to a place where it was not – and maybe we're not quite there yet, but where it's really not an issue if you're openly gay and running for office anymore. I mean, the end of the Clinton years, we had the Defense Marriage Act, of course, infamously the 2004 elections with George Bush making it a wedge issue. Were you surprised that progress wasn't quicker?
That it wasn't quicker?
Yeah. That it took until very recently for it to stop being such a lightning rod issue. Or maybe I have my history wrong. Maybe you think it did go quickly.
I think it was – I think we've made gradual progress since, what's it been now, 20 years?
21 years.
Yeah. I think we've made gradual progress. I think that at least in California, having LGBT candidates isn't all that uncommon.
Sure.
I think in some ways, I actually think it really is still a really important issue that LGBT people are elected to office because of the role models that they serve for young people, because of the importance of, when you're doing, advocacy in the state legislature, having someone who is personally affected by issues, who can look other legislators in the eye on the tough issues and say, I am personally affected by this, and can explain from personal experience how a vote really matters. And so I think there is a bit of an element on the progressive side that that all Democrats and all progressives are for LGBT rights, and that is more or less true, which wasn't the case when I ran. But there still is a really, I think, a big importance to having LGBT people having seats at the table. We're still underrepresented in California in the legislature compared to our the percentage that we are in the community. And state boards and commissions, we worked with the Williams Institute 2 years ago. They did a survey of 230-something boards and commissions in California, so that's a couple thousand appointees. There were only 14 openly LGBT people out of 2,000-something wow. appointments. So we've been working with Governor Brown's office to try to – we have this leadership academy to really trying to prepare people for public service through appointed positions and really creating a, you know, a pipeline of applicants into the governor's office. So, I mean, all those things are still really important.
Because if you ran today, I mean, no one would – you wouldn't have that addendum to your name in the newspaper. It's just different
right.
now.
Yeah. I wouldn't have the addendum to my name. I also raised a lot of money, though, because I had the addendum to my name and everyone across the country knew that it was significant. So in some ways, I had some advantages in 1996 that wouldn't necessarily be the case today. I think sort of issues of raising money and fundraising and even with progressive groups, it's not necessarily – it's not so unique and uncommon that that you know, that people weigh in. I mean, I think what's – similar now to what I was sort of facing in 1996 is what's happening in the transgender community. And we have very few transgender people elected to office. We've, you know, other than Judge Kalikowski in San Francisco, there's not a transgender person that's been elected in California. And we have an opportunity this year to elect Lisa Middleton to the Palm Springs City Council. And she actually, you know, has served as head of the Planning Commission, head of the, you know, the group that represents all of the community groups in town. And so – but she's, you know, she's facing the same kinds of issues that I think, you know, gay and lesbian candidates did before that, you know.
And you see the similar sort of fear-mongering around those issues, especially with the bathroom bill.
Right,
or,
right, with the bathroom bill and very, very similar kinds of things.
Just one last question because you've touched on it but we haven't really broached it is what are you doing now and how does it sort of – relate to your race in some ways?
Well, I never, you know, I never really thought that I'd be running an LGBT civil rights organization. I did it after I took an early retirement from Latham. And frankly, I was actually talking to some folks about a government appointment because I've always really wanted to have to do some public service.
Trump?
No, not with Trump. Not with Trump. I was hoping that there might be a different outcome in the election, but or in the state of California. And and basically, Equality California was struggling a little bit because they hadn't redefined the mission for the organization beyond marriage equality. And so basically about 2.5 years ago decided to the board asked me to sort of step in as executive director and help refocus the mission, rebrand the organization. And we're doing well. We're about 3 times the size of what we were when I started 2.5 years ago and really have a very ambitious program. Just opened on an office here in Washington, D.C., and we're going to be, you know, really focused on preserving the Affordable Care Act. The one thing I'll tell you is the most calls we got after the election, after Trump's election, into our office were all, I shouldn't say all, but predominantly LGBT people who are HIV positive or transgender or others who got their health care for the first time under the Affordable Care Act and are petrified of losing it. And so that for us is, you know, in addition to sort of at the federal level doing whatever we can to limit the rollback from on some of these executive orders and some of the other bad things that he wants to do. But preserving the Affordable Care Act is a really high priority for us.
That was Rick Zuber, former congressional candidate and now the executive director of Equality California. Candidate Confessional is produced and edited by Zach Young, who, as you know now, also wrote the theme music for this show. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your podcast platform of choice and spread the word. Just tell any random family member, stranger, person on the street that they should subscribe to. Next week, we are joined by not one but two senators, one former, one current, to talk about their attempts that failed to stop the Iraq War authorization in 2002. All right. Thank you so much. That wasn't that bad, right?
No. Interesting questions. I haven't thought about this stuff for years.
I appreciate it. Pretty good memory for being 20 years.
21 years ago, and you're like, 2 days after the election, I was doing this.